Hello, hello, and welcome back to Art House Garage, the snob-free movie podcast where we make art house, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I am your host, Andrew Sweatman. As we've been looking at the best films of 2020 for this season of the podcast, there's been a lot of options of what to discuss. I made a list of maybes, the films that we could cover this season, and it's a long list. It's been a little tricky to narrow the list down to decide what to talk about week to week. So I was thrilled when my friend and filmmaker Chad Hill reached out to me. He's been on the podcast before, several weeks ago, to discuss the political documentary The Way I See It. He sent me a message and asked if I had seen today's film, Baccarat, and he said he'd be up for a podcast discussion, and I said absolutely yes. Baccarat had been on my radar, and this gave me an excuse to prioritize it, and Chad is a great discusser of films, so I was more than happy to welcome him back to the show. Chad made a film recently called Invitation, and I saw it as part of the Filmland Festival Short Films this past October. Stay tuned because Chad and I will discuss it in this episode, and we'll share how you can see it online. Before we get into the episode proper, it's time for the Snob Free Glossary. This is the part of the show where we explain any films, filmmakers, or filmmaking terms that we reference later in the episode that you might be unfamiliar with, so you'll have the context you need to fully appreciate the discussion. Here we go. We talk a fair amount about the filmmaker John Carpenter. In case you've never heard of him, he's a director who had most of his biggest hits in the 70s and 80s, films like Halloween, Escape from New York, The Thing, and several more. He's known for his ability, among other things, to build tension, and that's what we discuss a little bit in the episode. We also talk about Paul Verhoeven. If you're not familiar with that name, he's the director of RoboCop, among other things. He's a Dutch director known for movies with a lot of graphic content mixed with social commentary. He also directed Total Recall, Basic Instinct, Showgirls, and Starship Troopers. Next up, Alejandro Jodorowsky is a very interesting filmmaker who I only became aware of myself in the last few years. He makes these very strange psychedelic films that are generally pretty well regarded in film circles. His films have a lot of religious symbolism, and they're just plain bizarre. If you want an idea of what I mean, go watch the trailer for his 1973 film, The Holy Mountain, on YouTube. It's pretty wild stuff. We also make mention of Sergio Leone, a filmmaker credited with creating the Spaghetti Western, which is called that because they're Westerns produced in Italy. Perhaps his best-known film is The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly from 1968, but he has a handful of other really well-known Westerns as well in his filmography. Fast-forwarding to more modern times, we discuss the director S. Craig Zahler, whose films Bone Tomahawk and Brawl in Cell Block 99 are highly critically acclaimed and also brutally violent. I mentioned briefly the film Django Unchained, which is a Quentin Tarantino film from 2012 that features Jamie Foxx as a former slave on a revenge tour and Leonardo DiCaprio as an over-the-top slaver. And finally, we make reference to the film Taxi Driver. This is the Martin Scorsese film from 1967 about a war veteran named Travis Bickle, played by a very young Robert De Niro. Travis Bickle has a job as a taxi driver and a penchant for violence. This is one of the all-time great films, and it's where we get the famous line, "You talking to me?
You talking to me? You talking to me?"
And that's it for the Snob-Free Glossary. On to the episode. As I mentioned before, Chad Hill is my guest this week, a filmmaker and an incredibly smart guy. I'm so happy to have him back on the show today. Welcome to the podcast, Chad Hill. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing fantastic. Yeah. Glad to be here and glad to be talking about this movie with you. This is a movie that I've been like, I saw it and I fell in love with it, and I'm shocked to see that not as many people are talking about it.
Yeah, no, I agree. I basically had heard the name of it and heard people saying man, that movie's crazy. And like, that was basically all I knew, but I heard more and more positive things about it. So I was excited when you actually reached out to me and said, hey, can we talk about Baccarat on the podcast? I was like, yeah, that sounds great. And gave me an excuse to watch it. And, so glad that I did, because yeah, I really, really liked it. Just before we get any further into that, I wanted to ask you, you're a filmmaker, and you had, last time you were here, we talked about your short, The Invitation. Or is it just Invitation? Just Invitation, right?
Yeah, it's just Invitation. Right. Everyone kind of has that impulse to add to the front of it. But it's just Invitation.
What's the latest with that?
Yeah, so we finished a festival run on it, and I'm looking at putting it online shortly. If it's not online at the time of this recording, it will Perfect. Be shortly thereafter, I guess, by the time the podcast comes out. But that'll be available probably on Vimeo and YouTube, and yeah. So
great. Yeah, I'll definitely link that in the show notes. And in case people weren't listening last time you were here, we talked about The Way I See It previously when you were on the podcast. And I talked about the film a little bit, just Invitation, because I had seen it at Filmland and really, really loved it. Actually, that's kind of how we met over Instagram. But it's got some religious themes. It's really funny. It's really, you know, one of those like funny and oddly moving kind of things. I think it's really well done. So highly recommend clicking the link in the show notes and taking a few minutes to watch that. Cool. All right. Well, without further ado, let's talk about Baccarat.
Gui, vamos olhar aqui, ó. Nós temos que procurar Baccarat no mapa, né? Ué, era pra estar aqui.
Cadê Baccarat?
Boa tarde, amigos de Baccarat.
Cada pode vir aqui pegar o mantimento que precisar, tá? Vamos usar a consciência, tá bom?
So this is Baccarat.
Quem nasce em Baccarat é o quê?
É a gente.
Cara, é treta em mim, velho.
Aqui nessa terra não pode acontecer dessa forma, não, viu?
A gente tá sendo atacado.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, let's talk about Baccarat. So this is a Brazilian film, kind of actually a collaboration between Brazil and France, Brazilian and French filmmakers. But this is a story that, you know, it's a little bit hard to classify. You could call it a Western, and I'm going to talk a little bit about, you know, that classification, but you can also call it a horror movie, I think. It even has some sci-fi elements. The setup, without spoiling anything, we're going to talk a little bit spoiler free. We will give a spoiler warning whenever we start talking about really the second two thirds of this movie. It just has a lot of juicy plot stuff that we need to talk about on a podcast, but it is, you know, something you wouldn't want to know going into this movie. But basically it's about a small village in Brazil, and it just, there's a lot of really foreboding things happening in the beginning, but it's you know, there's a truck full of caskets crashed on the side of the road, and that's one of the first things we see in the film. We learn that there's some political turmoil, they've been denied water, things are a little bit unusual, but really we get to know this village and the culture of this village. And there's a funeral happening from one of the village's matriarchs right in the beginning, who has, you know, been a staple of this community for a long time. But we get to know a lot of these different characters, and it really portrays them with dignity and respect that you would expect from a Brazilian filmmaker, I guess. But I guess it's one of the themes of the movie as it goes, is that they're not always treated with dignity and respect. And that's kind of the very, very basic setup. But then, yeah, more and more strange things start happening. Like they disappear from like Google Maps, with the equivalent of Google Maps. And then Basically a flying saucer shows up at a few moments. That's really odd. And I'm trying to think what else I can say without jumping into spoilers, but there's a lot of foreboding things on the horizon. What am I leaving out of a plot synopsis there, Chad? Help me out.
So I guess they're saying, like, the film starts by saying this is a few years from now. So yes, it's sometime in the near future. I think that's important that there's some very subtle, like almost so subtle you might not pick up on them, but very subtle dystopic elements to the film. Mm-hmm. Like, as we get the intro, the kind of our entry point character is this woman named Teresa, who's a doctor, and she's returning to the village for the first time specifically for this matriarch's funeral. And along the way, we get some really great details of, you know, we're in this water truck that's driving water into the city, and we're passing old schools, dilapidated schools in the middle of nowhere. They've been shut down, and truck crashed on the highway with the caskets. And, you know, it's very clearly, like, if we didn't get that title card saying this sometime in the future, we would assume, like, oh, this is probably modern day or maybe sometime in the near past in this area. And then we see this futuristic digital console on the dashboard of the truck that they're driving in, that gives information, that's giving news bulletins on some turmoil that's happening somewhere in the country, and particularly a wanted poster where we learn about this gang that's holding the water supply hostage nearby because the government is not giving them what they need. And there's a lot of really just striking little subtle details like that where we get the sense of this world, like, and I don't know if you want to jump in and talk about the movie. I was just
going into plot details. Great. That's beautifully said, and a really good kind of synopsis, I think, of at least the beginning of this movie. So without getting into the spoiler stuff yet, this really struck me primarily as a horror movie, even though that's not how it's really classified. Just because I don't know, from the beginning I sense, you know, something is going to go wrong here, but it also it stood out for me. I don't know, it just seemed like there's so many horror movies out there that kind of don't break through, and I was just trying to think, like, what about this makes it so much better than a lot of other horror movies. So I wanted to see, what in your mind, what makes this movie special or sets it apart?
Yeah, the thing for me that sticks out the most, the thing that feels most like, is, like, this feels like a John Carpenter film, like a modern day John Carpenter film. And not just in the sense that we get a lot of that nowadays, particularly, like, the 80s homage is something that we're kind of all stuck in with, you know, things like Stranger Things and, some low grade sci-fi action horror stuff like BFW from last year that kind of mimic the overall plot, and maybe some of the neon and the scents and the grungy aesthetic of it and the ultraviolence that are kind of calling back to that type of movie. But this feels like a John Carpenter joint to me, like in the truest sense, that it has, from a directorial standpoint, has his patience. It has the willingness to kind of soak into the world and let the characters in the world reveal themselves very slowly. And it just has that mood to it. And so I feel, and I think it's an active, like, knowing homage to John Carpenter too. Like, when you know, that opening credits, we get the font style that everyone likes to mimic, and we get a little bit of that sense in the score. But the most striking thing is that the tension that the director, and I'm going to butcher this name, Kleber Mendoza Fijo, is like that, and his collaborator are able to build with this film, you know, and even in all the small dystopic details and everything, feels in the truest sense like an actual, like, I was about to say ripoff. That's not accurate at all. But like, we've transported, like, it feels like a movie that he didn't get to make.
So there's not a ton of just, you know, background information out about this, because it's fairly recent. I think it was originally hit festivals in 2019, but it's been considered a 2020 film, because I think that's when it got its wide release. But it
premiered at Cannes in 2019, and then it had its rollout. It kind of got lost in the COVID-19 shuffle when things started locking down. Like, I think that's when it was starting to get its theatrical release, and you know, unfortunately, it just kind of got lost in the shuffle.
Oh, this would have been great on the big screen too. Man, what a theatrical experience it would have been. But I did find one short interview with the directors, and they mentioned John Carpenter by name as an influence, in the saying that that's what they grew up with in the 70s, and they wanted to kind of bring that to a modern movie. It's definitely has that so much tension. I think for me, as far as what makes it, you know, I don't know, sets it apart in a ways, is just how dialed in and immersed into this culture that we get before we have any of the horrific elements coming through. Like, again, the paranoia is there from the beginning, but there we really, really get to spend time with this community and meet the different people. In this short interview I watched, they said they really considered the community to be the main character. There's not really one standout. Like there's an entry point through Teresa, but we really kind of get to know them as a group and care for them as a group, you know, as the plot's unfolding. And I think that's really well done.
Right.
And some of it is this funeral scene, and we see like there's this really striking funeral procession with this guy playing guitar at the front. There's children, and we see like the school and the teacher, who is also the main character, sort of main character, Teresa's father. And there's this DJ who gets on the microphone to like tell the news to the town. And there's just all these different people.
And we also get Sonia Braga playing this woman who shows up to the funeral drunk, who's clearly, you know, an old friend of the woman who died, but she has some very, very, you know, some resentment and some unkind things to say about her, you know, that she probably only would say if she was drunk, but it's that kind of spirited, you get such a strong sense of the character and the relationships within the community just in that first part, even before you get any hints that something foreboding or something bad is coming. You get this strong sense of the community and how all these people relate to each other.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, and then she ends up being a pretty big character as it goes on. She's sort of the town doctor. But yeah, that you're right, the relationship is clear there, because she shows up and, you know, you might think, oh, she's making a fool of herself, but they clearly the husband, who he's kind of giving a speech at the time, he kind of basically really respectfully says, you know, she's having a hard time, like whatever, and it's clear that like there's mutual respect and love here in this town. I should say it's a fictional town and then called Bacarau. That is where the title comes from, but it's sort of based on some real villages, and it's shot on location in kind of remote places in Brazil. So I want to talk about like kind of the genre stuff a little more. When I looked up, before I'd even watched it, I just looked on the Wikipedia page for like the basic bare bones of what this is. And it uses the phrase, weird Western. And that was something I think I'd heard before, but I like it's on Wikipedia, you know, you can like click it. Like there's another page just for weird Western. So I looked into that, and it basically is when there's a Western that has a significant science fiction or horror or like occult things mixed together with it. And I don't know if I've seen many weird Westerns, but I think this definitely would fit into that category. And
there's a few different things that it reminds me of. So I know we mentioned John Carpenter is a huge influence, and that's what the filmmakers themselves have said. But, you know, I'm picking up some, you know, Paul Verhoeven in terms of some of the anti-racist and anti-fascist strains that the story has in it. In addition to the ultra violence that we eventually get later in the movie. Mm-hmm. And then I'm also picking up like Alejandro Jodorowsky, his Westerns, you know, his very bizarre Westerns. There's some touches of that, particularly some of the drug-fueled visuals that we get scattered throughout the film. And then I also there's a little bit of Sergio Leone in here too. It's a little cliche to call back to them anytime you get like kind of your non-traditional Western in there, but there's some of that too. And it's not surprising. I'm sure when we're talking about weird Westerns, you can maybe mention Bone Tomahawk from a few years ago being in that strain as well.
Yeah. I have not seen Bone Tomahawk, but But yeah, that sounds.
Oh,
like
that's a gnarly piece of work right there.
I've heard it's pretty
really
intense.
Really gnarly, and it's yeah, it's interesting because you know really the place where this film shifts is when we have kind of C-list genre icon Udo Kier shows mm-hmm. up about mm-hmm. midway through the movie, and that's really the point where the movie kind of shifts into the more the genre infused things and the S. Craig Zahler, the director and writer of Bone Tomahawk, he pulled the exact same thing with his next film, Brawl in Cell Block 99, mm-hmm. Which I don't know. I guess it's the kind of thing where you get a guy like Udo Kier who is, you know, just a lot of fun to see in anything, and he's kind of just your genre signifier of yeah. Okay, we're gonna get weird, you know.
yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, along the lines of that, I guess the quote-unquote weirdness of it. We should mention it starts in outer space. Literally, the credits are in outer space, and then it kind of zooms into to Earth, into Brazil. So there's that kind of sci-fi touch to it, and then the music. So I guess on the western side of it, it is this kind of rural village, and there's an outside threat. So that's kind of a western trope. And you also have all these kind of landscape shots and some kind of big theatrical grandiose music that you might hear in a western, but then you also have all this like psychedelic sounding electronic music that comes in at different times, and it's so interesting and it's so cool. Honestly, I was like, this is really great. Like, anytime it would make those shifts back and forth, it did that I think in a really masterful way. So yeah, definitely all those genres come together, I think, in a really well done way. I think another thing for me that worked really well about this is just how well written the characters are. And so as we, again, as I was mentioning, the community, we kind of get to know all these people. They feel really lived in and really like real people. And then once we meet some other characters that we'll get to in the spoiler talk, they're from a very different context, but they also are just incredibly well written. They feel like real people. And I think you don't always get that with like a quote unquote horror movie either. Is that you have, you know, maybe a faceless villain, or maybe you have, you know, just the bare setup to get to the scary, violent stuff. But this really takes its time with that kind of setup, and it's just, I think they're really well written. It also really takes its time when, you know, tragic things do begin to happen. It takes time to sit with the tragedy of it, and so we're not going to just. And that's actually a theme of the movie, I think, in a sense, too, which we maybe will talk about in spoilers, but that, like, these are real people, and when someone from this small community dies, it affects the entire community, not just at that opening funeral, but then there is some violence happening later, and it you sit with the people that are affected the greatest by that. And so I think that's another really effective thing this does, to let you feel the depth of those losses every time someone is killed.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
And then one other thing before we get into spoilers, just like, I think what's really great about this too, is that it just gives you, enough of what's going on. Like, it never just flat out lays out, here's what's happening with, this outside threat. But it, you have to like really pull and figure it out kind of as you go. But it, mm-hmm. it becomes pretty clear, but it's still something you have to kind of work for. And that just made for a really engaging experience, I think, which, again, a similar movie like this might just, you know, here's what's going on, let's jump into it. But this really kind of weaves that into a strong narrative, I think, in a way that's just really well done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one of the great things. And that goes into the, you know, it's not just the story and the script, but the production design, kind of like mm-hmm. what I mentioned earlier with the details. I think it helps that Filho's co-director, Giuliano Dornelis, he served as his production designer on his previous two features. And so coming from that background and having a production designer working on set, like, it's everything, it's clearly, like, it's not the highest budget film out there. Mm-hmm. So, like, it's not necessarily that it hints at some of these other little details about the world of the film. You know, none of them are like really overt or, you know, expensive or obvious, but they're small and they're very well thought out and they're seeded through. Just, you know, one of the things that I love, going back to that opening funeral, whenever they're doing the funeral procession, the DJ, he's got this truck and he's got this giant jumbotron on the back of the truck mm-hmm. with speakers that are playing the music. And it's just the kind of thing that, you know, for the setting, for, kind of as, you know, traditional, possibly even, you know, traditional village that, you know, possibly is very old and has these indigenous roots. You know, you can kind of imagine some of the architecture and, you know, the dirt roads and things like that. It's very rural and it's very old, but they do have this modern technology, but it's not so advanced that, it, you know, it feels authentic to like the kind of like, oh, this is very advanced technology, but it's you know, it's probably on the cheaper end of it to where it feels like, okay, this is probably what a village like this could afford, you know, would have.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. I think that's well said. Do you have any other spoiler-free thoughts before we get into some spoiler questions?
No, I don't think so. I think really the meat of this movie, like you can't talk about what this movie is doing and kind of what its point is without diving into.
Yes, completely.
Yeah.
Well, then, if you have not watched Back Around, we recommend going and watching it now instead of listening to the rest of this right now. Absolutely, we both recommend it. So it's worth watching. It's on Criterion Channel streaming, or you can rent it online. And there's your spoiler warning. From here forward, we are going to be talking about details all the way to the end of the movie. So tune out now if you don't want to hear that. All right, let's talk spoilers. So... yeah, from basically the first after that first third, we jump into that, you know, you're right, because the villain here, he's like a C-list horror movie villain. This movie almost would, I guess that's why I wanted to compare it to other horror movies, because his inclusion and just kind of the vibe of this group of villains feels like something that would be very at home in a C-list horror movie, but it's in this really pretty elevated, like art house Western. And so I think that juxtaposition is really interesting too. So anyway, that's plot wise. What happens is we find out that there's a group of people, Americans mostly, who are just hunting the villagers. And, we don't find out till the end exactly why, but I think I suspected it had to do with the political situation in Brazil. And that is that there's this politician who shows up named, Thomas Jr. And he is very clearly hated by the village because he's mixed up in the reason they don't have water. And, there's a lot of tension there. So anyway, it starts with these two people coming into town on their motorcycles wearing these bright colors. They obviously don't really fit in, but they speak Portuguese and they kind of interact with the villagers. And people are very suspicious of them. Also, the night before, a pack of horses has escaped from a nearby farm. We find out they've been killed. Anyway, if you've seen the movie, you know all this. So I guess let's get into, for me, the political side of this is probably the most interesting thing. So I wanted to ask you. So what I read on Wikipedia said that this does draw from modern Brazilian political situations, which I'm not so familiar with, but it also had a lot of resonance for me with American politics. So anyway, I want to see, what's your take on kind of the politics of Bacurau?
Yeah, so obviously, like, neither of us is Brazilian, and I'm by no means a Brazilian historian. So as far as being tapped into, you know, what their political landscape looks like, you know, there's not a whole lot of that. But I feel like, just, you know, if you go back to the history of, you know, Spanish conquest of South America, there's a lot of their, you know, history and their, you know, cultural shifts that's tied into the same colonial forces that settled and took over America. And so I think one of the things in particular that's, I guess, might be surprising is that also in Brazil, and as evidenced by this film, is that anti-black racism is also a problem in Brazil. Like one of the key things I feel that makes, you know, this village, if not a target of the people they're trying to eliminate them, then at the very least makes them less quote unquote valued, you know, like more expendable. It would be that it's mostly a black and indigenous village. That's a key figure. You know, whenever we meet this group of people that are, you know, kind of shutting down, they're cutting off their communications. They've removed them from Google Maps. You know, they're kind of monitoring them with this drone. Is that they, one of the key things with there is that they're mostly Americans, but they're two people that they've been relying on for, I guess, for reconnaissance, mm-hmm. Are Brazilians. And they're very light-skinned Brazilians, yeah. like people who would be white-passing mm-hmm. otherwise. And there's a really tense scene, where we kind of meet the broader group after we've met these two people, where yeah. that's specifically like commented on and made a big point of that. Mm-hmm. This group of people, again, who's mostly Americans, and then Udo Kier is obviously German, do not treat them like they are a part of the group. They're basically just useful. And to that point, you mentioned that, you kind of took it as these people have been hired to take out this town for the politicians. And mm-hmm. I did not, again, like the film doesn't go out of its way to specify and really elaborate on the situation a whole lot. But the way that I read it was that these were mainly just tourists, that these people wanted to, these are people who were, wanting to indulge in some violent tendencies for themselves, mm-hmm. and that this was a service that they were being offered, and that it was mainly just convenient as far as the political stuff, particularly that politician that comes in and is meant to provide them water and books and does it in like the most derisive way possible, mm-hmm. Literally just hauling in a dump truck of old books and dumping it on the ground for them. At one point in the movie, that it's mainly just convenient for the politicians. But that I read that as not being the main purpose, though. It was mainly that these people genuinely were just on a violence kick.
Interesting. Yeah, that's really interesting. So at the end, the moment where the politician's there and they've captured the German villain here, and he keeps saying his name, and the politician's saying, "I don't know you. Stop saying my name, friend." Like I read that as he's trying to distance himself there in this moment. But I read that as like he was responsible. Maybe he's not. But here's where I think that's a strength of this movie, honestly, that it can be ambiguous in that way. But I just imagined that he was like, "Hey, I gotta get rid of this village. I'm gonna find somebody who can take it out." And then this German villain had no problem going to America and finding people who just wanted to come and kill people, like, and then he kind of assembled this ragtag team of violence hungry bloodthirsty Americans to come and kill people. But yeah, again, that is all something I read into it, so I don't know if that's how that went down, but
I guess my thinking, we've talked about how well written the characters for the village are, but mm-hmm. I think once we meet I don't know what you want to call them, this spec ops group. Yeah. I don't know, mm-hmm. like these violence tourists or whatever. Whenever you meet them, they're equally like well written, like you just as well written mm-hmm. as you get such a strong sense of all of their psychologies and everything. And mm-hmm. in those subtle character details, I'm seeing like a genuine like bloodthirstiness. Like, and some of these people are very clearly not professionals. You know, they're mm-hmm. amateurs at best. And they're talking about they're wanting a certain kill count, like mm-hmm. they get angry that, someone has taken their kill or that there's they even question, whenever they end up killing those two Brazilians that have been helping them, they argue about whether or not that counts to towards their score. Yeah. And I think they actually use that terminology, score. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. It's a lot of those very small and very subtle details that point to this maybe being something that, like, this is a service. Like, these are not highly trained,
mm-hmm.
highly capable group of people. These are people who are doing this because they want to.
Yeah. I think I basically am agreeing with you. I imagined him, like, going to find, everyday bloodthirsty mm-hmm. people in America. Because I think one of them, he even says, like, he works in HR for a retail store or something like that, and some of them look kind of like tough soldiers and others don't, right? And some of them just seem mm-hmm. like corporate like blue collar workers who have put on armor and grabbed guns for the day. It's really interesting. So I agree, like I think I was surprised at how well written those characters were, because I think, okay, this is a Brazilian town, these are Brazilian filmmakers, and so it makes sense that they are like giving a lot of life to this this community, and then we meet these villains, and they feel just as real. It's absolutely believable that there are Americans that are this bloodthirsty and would go and treat these people mm-hmm. like, you know, a video game, you know, with the way they're just wanting to mow them mm-hmm. down. And like that one woman, I think one of the first times we really see that in action is there's a man and a woman, and they chase down this car at night that's trying to escape. And she's like, obviously very excited before. And it's like, I can't remember her line. She's like, this is freaking awesome. And just like so excited. And then they brutally murder these people. And then she's really sexually turned on by it. And she makes that clear. And so it's despicable on all fronts, but it's absolutely like, it just feels like, yes, there are real people in America right now that would probably do this, sadly, mm-hmm. you know? But I think it also works on a symbolic level of, like, I read it kind of as imperialism or colonialism, like we're coming in and taking over and wiping out the old culture, you know, but this is saying, what if that literally happened in this way? Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. One thing in the, so I felt another kind of commonality with modern politics at one point because of a word that is used. That opening, that scene where we first meet everyone at that meeting, that's about a third into the movie. It really, I think, is a key scene because we kind of start to understand the character of everyone and how racist they all really are. And they say that thing about the light-skinned Brazilians. One of the leader says, don't speak Brazilian here, which of course, Brazilian is not a language, like it's Portuguese. Like mm-hmm. that's just a little, right. little detail that shows his either ignorance or willful ignorance about that. But then he says something, well, I think it's the leader, but it's someone in the group says something about shithole towns, which mm-hmm. of course directly parallels Donald Trump saying shithole countries. And mm-hmm. so there's that kind of direct parallel. And then in the interview that I watched, they mentioned like, we had a script coming together, but once Donald Trump was elected, it like we wrote the final draft right away, like that cemented all of this. So I think if I watched this movie like 10 years ago, even I might think these villains are like cartoonishly bad, but mm-hmm. in the last few years it's become clear that, you know, that's not that cartoonish, it's not that far-fetched that someone would be right. this close-minded and terrible in a situation like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's certain points that I mean, there's a strong sense of, you know, not just the anti-black racism, but touching on the indigenous culture that's here, there's a certain regard, you know, that's still very prevalent, you know, in society to treat indigenous cultures as inherently uncivilized or mm-hmm. you know, that I guess almost a slur of a sort is you know, the word savage. And I think that mm-hmm. that is the way that this film engages with that dichotomy is really fascinating mm-hmm. to me, because I think that there's, you know, if you really pay attention, and this is where the, you know, wonderful production design and the writing comes into play, is that, you know, this town has a history with colonial powers and with rebellion against colonial powers. The town has this museum that we see early on, where apparently there was an uprising where the local indigenous population beheaded and brutally murdered some of the encroaching colonial forces. Mm-hmm. And that is a little bit of a foreshadowing of what, you know, what is to come, you know, mm-hmm. of how the film resolves. But I think one of the things that, you know, it's engaging with this idea that the violence that our villains, that Udo Kier and his group of violence tourists are, you know, are visiting upon this town, is that inherently less, you know, more civilized or any less savage than what, than what these locals are capable of. And I think that there's a very in-your-face quality to the way the violence, particularly that last showdown, whenever they finally mm-hmm. Decide to go after everyone in the town, of how the locals engage in the violence and how the film frames it, mm-hmm. because it is brutal and it is very, if you want, and it very much, you know, fits visually and fits into, I guess, what we would imagine that violence would have been like. And it's very brutal. And it's very nasty. And in particular, There's one group of, like, a pair of our villains go to this far off cottage to get these two locals that are kind of out by themselves. And it's very interface bad that these locals, they're walking around outside their house naked, in the nude, like, you know, and that's sort of visually immediately recalls in your mind, like, oh, these uncivilized people don't even wear clothes, you know, that kind of thing. And then it's very much putting all of that, those attitudes in your face, you know, and contrasting it against what our villains are doing and their attitudes towards these people, like, because of what they think about these cultures and these, you know, societal forces that have constructed them to see these people this way, that they inherently view them as disposable or less worthy of life, you know.
Oh, and during that meeting scene, one of them literally says, and I came for the body count. I think you mentioned that. And the other fighting over how many kills each other got. The reason they're so mad at the reconnaissance to pair that they had was because they weren't supposed to kill anyone, but save those kills for the Americans. Yeah. So it's
right.
It's it's really an interesting setup for a movie. And I thought too about, like, how, like, aimless, like, literally they're there to kill people, which again, like, on one hand feels so extreme that you might say it's unbelievable or like it's clearly just symbolic for this movie, but I think there are those clear parallels too, to like even the insurrection, you know, a week and a half ago or whatever, they didn't have any real, you know, aim. They were just gonna go mess things up, and that was like the whole thing, and so it just really felt up a piece with that. Another thing that I thought was really interesting in the interview with the directors, which I'll link in the show notes, was they mentioned, you know, we at no point do we think this is what all Americans are like, whatever, but the gun culture of the U.S. is something that the whole world is aware of, is what this director said, and so we were kind of using that to our advantage in the story here, that that's a real way that people behave. So I thought that was really a fascinating point that that he brought in there. But
there's going to be one day that I come on this podcast and we don't get political.
Yes.
Has to be at some point, but yeah. You know.
Yep. Yeah, I was just thinking that too. Like, when Chad comes, we talk about all the politics.
it's a little difficult to escape. And yeah. Really, I mean, the best thing that I feel like any media or any art could do is, you know, reflect or comment on our political reality, you know, whether it's overtly or, you know, just in the broader strokes. But, you know, it is important to talk about these things.
Yeah, I completely agree. One thing about this movie that I did have sort of a question mark about in my brain was they frequently are taking this drug, and I didn't quite understand like the significance of it or just what, if it was just an excuse to kind of have some of these psychedelic moments. But then whenever the politician comes and brings, you know, some food, some old expired food and that sort of thing, he brings also a box of, I think, the same drug. Was that your understanding, that was the same thing? And what do you make of the drug situation?
So if you're talking about the drugs that they seem to be taking that causes the hallucinogens, I think it's different from what they bring the people. But I think I mainly read that like that was sort of a traditional thing, you know, going back to, you know, I guess we're never told what drug specifically it is, but particularly, you know, there's some aspects of indigenous cultures that are associated with hallucinogenic drugs, as part of a ritual, as part of their religious practices or whatever. And so I guess I read that mainly at the beginning when they were taking that as sort of a way for them to sort of a last vestige of that tradition, like a way to carry on that tradition within their community. And then later on, I think it plays into you know, some stereotypes about indigenous peoples that, you know, they take these drugs and it makes them more violent and more savage. And so I think that is, that's played with a little bit, particularly, you know, when we get to that showdown at the end, is that these people, you know, are indulging in these drugs, you know, and, that's possibly helping commit this violence, but it is just violence. Like, would you fault them, you know, would anyone fault them for doing the things that they were doing, particularly whenever you see, you know, that they And this is just a great detail too, just going back to that truck at the beginning with the coffins that's crashed on the side of the road, that just how many freaking coffins they have ready, you know, at the end to pack up all these people and just disappear them, you know, for no reason. But, you know,
yeah, it's wild. On that note, there's a lot of really great images, I think, in this. Like if you watch the teaser trailer, you're going to see several of them. Like there's a dog on the street in the middle of the night and all the horses suddenly come in and he like barely jumps out of the way. That's a striking shot. And yeah, the coffins at the beginning, one of them, like they're swerving around some, but then one of them just, they run over and it just gets smashed. And then at the funeral scene too, one of the most striking ones, I think, is the coffin overflowing with water, which does seem to be something she's hallucinating because she's taking one of the pills kind of right when she got into town. But that's like a really interesting metaphor. I think too about the way that the water is being held as a political thing, that like they're being denied their very, basic human needs and because of politics basically. And so that's an interesting way to like kind of bring the water into this macabre, like flowing out of this coffin. It's an interesting moment there, but interesting. That makes sense about the drug as far as kind of playing into the indigenous culture and being something that would be believable, but also something that you'd see these kind of racists holding against them in a way. That's a good reading of that, I think. What do you think about the ending? Does the final scene work for you, like the big action scene? Big action scene might not be the right word, because I think one of the things I like about it is that it's not a huge explosive shootout that you might expect. But yeah, what do you think about the final scenes?
Yeah, I think we've talked about how violent, you know, we've talked about the ultra violence and some of these other homages and other influences this movie has, particularly John Carpenter and I pulled Paul Verhoeven out of the blue. But I don't know, I feel like the ending, like as gory and violent as it is, I feel like it was a bit of a surprise, because I think there's probably people who, you know, once they pick up on where the film is going and what it's going to be, they're going to be wanting and expecting this very, you know, righteous shootout. The town rises up against these people, and they do that, but it's not the satisfying, you know, the gratifying Hollywood shootout that we expect to see. It's very, you know, it's very quick. Like the violence is very quick. Yeah. It's very brutal.
Some of it's off screen, even. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of it is off screen, and some of it is even pretty perfunctory. You know, like it's more like it's sort of an inevitability, and we're kind of meant to.
Yeah.
Like even though it is righteous and it is just, you know, in this instance, we're kind of meant to admire is not necessarily the word, but to kind of observe the inherent horror of it, that this had to be done, and that it was end up being inevitable. And I think that's a really fascinating and thoughtful place for this film to end up, you know, as much joy as there is in the genre thrills and in the mystery and in all the trappings of it, I think that it really does end in a place where it denies us kind of what we expect to get.
Yeah, I completely agree. There's that really violent moment when the couple on the outskirts and they surprise, they have a gun and they shoot the guy's head off, and it's extremely violent. Like,
it's just gone. Like the bottom. Like, I just love the prosthetic on that. It's literally just like his bottom jaw, and the rest of it is gone.
Shocking moment. Like that, I thought about like Django Unchained. Actually, like the ending of that movie is so bloody, and it kind of took me to that spot. But yeah, I think so. Then you expect, you know, some big badass action scene at the end, and that's not at all what we get. Like you're saying, that it, and I think in doing so, you realize, like, again, these are real people. As much as it's great that they're going to win this fight, it is still really affecting them as a society. Like, this is going to take a toll on them. And I love the moment when, first of all, just the museum, the fact that they have a little history museum in their town, and we don't really get to see inside of it. I thought someone was going to go in it early in to the movie. Someone walks by and it makes a show of like the title of the building. Like, this is a history of Baccarat. And I was like, that, I bet it's really interesting. And then just kind of goes on. And then during this scene, one of the villains goes in there, and then you see, so it's almost signaling to us as the audience, like, they know what they're doing in this kind of a situation, because we see like a news article about the previous battle that was fought here and the heads of their enemies.
Yeah, like I think there's that. Yeah, it's like the picture of, you know, all the beheaded people, like all the heads lined up in front of the church.
Yeah. So you think like maybe this guy's a little nervous, but he still thinks he's going to win this fight. But then he goes in the next room and starts reading. There's an empty wall. It's just such a great moment. An empty wall, and he starts reading the things, and it's the guns that they used in this previous fight, and now they're gone. So then he kind of realizes, oh my gosh, we're in for it. That's a great moment. I did have a question. So the main villain, or I keep forgetting his name. Let me look really quick at the German.
Michael.
Yes, Michael. Yeah. He's kind of on the outskirts, and he's kind of messing with his own people, and at one point he actually kills one of his own men, and I thought that was kind of confusing. I don't know if I missed something with that. What was your take on that situation?
Yeah, are you talking about at the end?
Yeah,
like in the ending.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I mean, I pictured it because I think basically at that point in the film, Michael is, you know, he's got his sniper rifle and his scope, and he's basically mm-hmm. kind of watching and monitoring things. Mm-hmm. I think he picks up on what's happening and which way the wind's blowing mm-hmm. very quickly in that scene. And so I think he just kind of realizes, well, this is screwed. You know, so he knows what's going to happen anyway, regardless of whether or not he does anything. So he kind of takes it into his own hands to try to at least eliminate all of the people that could explain or, you know, tie up the loose ends for who else would be, you know, outside of this group would be responsible for this.
That makes total sense. And I think we should say too, like he's the leader of this group, but he also doesn't really like them. He has some contempt for them.
Oh yeah.
And there's a really interesting scene too earlier where one of them kills a child and claims he doesn't know it was a child, thought it was a teenager, which is obviously ridiculous because it's a 9-year-old mm-hmm. kid, and they're having a conflict about that, and he comes in, and then one of them calls him a Nazi, and he takes serious offense to that, which just adds to all the different racial biases and cultural biases happening within this group, and that I thought it was just an interesting touch that they would bring that.
What's fascinating to me about that moment, if you weren't going to mention it, I was going to bring it up, that I don't know. I think it's not even just that he takes offense to it, but I think he's just like he's mad because it's lazy. Like mm-hmm. it's just like it's such like the easy go-to insult, and he says that in the film. But I think there's also a key strain to that of, you know, these Americans who are basically like they are doing Nazi shit.
Yeah,
like that's what they're doing. They're mm-hmm. they're doing Nazi shit. And I apologize for cursing. So I think it's just funny that like, you know, that's kind of commenting on this strain of, you know, mm-hmm. you know, the American fascism that we've seen that, you know, kind of crop up under Trump in the last few years that, you know, Americans were so, we have such a specific image of what fascism is and what evil is, you know, and what this violence looks like that we don't, you know, it's almost like whenever it's happening right in front of our faces, we don't recognize it because it's not dressed up the way that we expect it to.
The American version.
And so yes, exactly. And so I think that it's telling that when this American calls him a Nazi, there's that disconnect in between, and he calls him out on it that, like, you know, like what are you doing? You know?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of hypocritical of you.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, not just that it is lazy and it's easy and he's offended by it, but also like, dude, look at yourself.
Look at what you're doing. You know? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And so this is another just kind of side tangent, but I think another just really great instance of writing character dialogue is when they're approaching the town and one of them talks about this anger that he felt when it actually reminded me of like Taxi Driver, because he talks about this anger he felt when he was dumped and he went to his wife's house to kill her with all his guns because he's a gun enthusiast, all this. And she's not there, and so he said, and then I went to the mall, and I went to the park, and all the, I couldn't quite do it, but I had this thing I had to deal with, like I had this chip on my shoulder I had to do something about, and this was the perfect way to deal with it, to come here and shoot these nameless for him nameless and faceless quote-unquote savages. And so I thought that was just like, again, adding dimension to these people who, like, again, it's sadly believable, I guess. That's the thing I'm getting at of. It's that mm-hmm. like as wild as it is, it's it's written in a way that feels like it could be real. But anyway, yeah. Do you have any other kind of thoughts about Baccarat before we kind of wrap things up?
You know, I think this was something that, like, even, you know, I had heard, you know, great things about it, you know, and I really, you know, was kind of looking forward to getting to see it, you know, before the pandemic started. And when I finally got around to it, I was still, like, just shocked how blown away I was. This is, I think this is one of my favorite films of the year. And I think a lot more people should see it.
I completely agree. Like, if I had seen it by the end of the year, I might have, you know, put it on my top 10 list. And I don't know, that's behind me, so I don't have to worry about it. I stress about those lists way too much. It's not a big deal.
Right.
But yeah, this is absolutely one of the better things I saw from 2020. And, you know, I think it's probably not for everyone in the way that's something like, I don't know, like First Cow.
Right. It is a little bit slow getting out. Like I said, I think when people call back to John Carpenter, you know, talk about how much they love his films, I think a lot of them forget how slow and deliberate a lot of his films can be. And this definitely has that to it, so
but I really think it makes most of the slowness at the beginning, especially. I mean, even throughout it, it's a patient movie. Even when the violence starts breaking out, it's not like moving quickly like a thriller at all. It's I guess more like a Western. It's kind of taking its time, and anyway, very good movie. I definitely highly recommend it. And so if you're listening this far, you've probably already seen it. I'd say recommend this to your friends and try to get more people to see it, because I think it really is worth seeing. Thank you so much, Chad, for joining the podcast again. I think this has been a great conversation.
Yeah, I've absolutely enjoyed it.
And thanks for putting me onto this movie, because I might have gotten to it otherwise, but I'm glad that you put me onto it.
Yeah, absolutely. Always glad to share recommendations with people, especially whenever they turn out to be, you know, enjoyed.
Yes, very, very much so. Big, big thanks again to Chad Hill for joining me today. Stay tuned to the podcast in the coming weeks for some more great movie discussions. Coming up, we've got an episode on the gorgeous animated film Wolfwalkers, as well as the incredible documentary Boy State. And thank you so much for listening to Arthouse Garage. We've got a few years worth of episodes. You can hear all of those in your podcast app of choice. Our theme music is by composer Paul Hunefeld. You can learn more about him and his work at appallingproductions.com. If you want to support Arthouse Garage, you can leave a rating or review in your podcast app, or you can buy an Arthouse Garage t-shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. Stay in the loop about Arthouse Garage and the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter by going to arthousegarage.com/subscribe, or you can email me directly. I'm andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search at Arthouse Garage in all those places, or find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening. And until next time, keep it snob free.